Hey, everybody, thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. This week's show is brought to you by lynda.com. That's lynda.com, a huge online learning resource. Get your 7-day free trial at lynda.com/shoptalk. And Environments for Humans, who are running their second in-person Artifact Conf at artifactconf.com. This one's coming to Providence, Rhode Island, just about an hour outside of Boston. Check that out. We'll tell you about these stuff later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off.
Hello and welcome to the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Tiffercoyer.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening. And we have with us Nicholas Gallagher. Thanks for joining us, Nicholas.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Right. So good. You might know Nicholas from every GitHub repo on the internet. Am I correct in saying that?
No, but thanks.
I know Nicholas from NicholasGallagher.com, where he's kind of one of those guys where he doesn't blog very often, but when he does, you should read it. That kind of the point there. Yeah, there's a lot of like seminal articles on there that cover a lot of ground that's good. So it's kind of like I think maybe back in the day it was like Pseudo Elements where I kind of tried to W Dr. Pseudo Element,
right.
And it didn't take very well. Didn't work very well.
Probably for the best.
And then recently I actually got to meet you for the first time at that W3 conf that was in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Which was cool, and your talk was kind of like, I mean, I don't remember exact every detail, but it was kind of like about, you know, front-end pragmatics in a way, and look, oh, semantics, those are nice and everything, but look at how far down the semantic hole I've tried to dig, which was kind of a reference back to your pseudo-element days, and like, I tried to go so far out of my way to avoid putting a div on the page, and then in more modern times, you're like, man, that was maybe that wasn't the correct thinking. And so now you have some guides to kind of pragmatic front-end architecture and CSS and stuff. Kind of changed your tune on that a little bit.
I don't know. Basically, I kind of... I think I just misunderstood semantics based off what everyone else had been saying, I suppose. I just kind of went along with what was being told, this kind of very dogmatic approach to things. And then just kind of...
Was that the thing that got you into the pseudo elements at all? Was that kind of like, look, we can be more semantic if we use these instead of divs?
Actually, it was more that one day, like, I quit my job and I spent a lot of time, like, unemployed. And then I was looking at the ClearFix code and I was just like, what is this thing? Like, I've used it all the time and I have no idea what this colon after means or what the content property means. And so I just started... I didn't even Google it. I just started changing code in that piece of ClearFix and was like making weird shapes appear on the screen. And then I thought, oh, this is quite fun. And then later I was like, oh, you can do things. And then I tried to justify my procrastination by talking about how it would help you keep your code semantic, something like that.
It ended up being a justification.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. I get that. And that ClearFix stuff is pretty interesting. So that, I don't know if it even has a name, like the new ClearFix or the micro ClearFix, which is, has a kind of magically, everybody uses it now, you know, like I don't have any like data that has crawled the internet and got every single ClearFix code, but it tends to, when I look at stuff, it uses it doesn't have all that crazy stuff that used to be in it before. Like people used to, you know, like make sure you have a period in the content property.
Yeah.
That type of weird stuff that ended up being, it really didn't mean anything. It just was a weird misconception that just hung on.
Well,
for a long
there were some
time.
Good reasons for it at the time when the browsers that needed to be supported, I think some old version of Firefox in particular, like kind of needed that in there for some reason. But by the
so there was reasons.
Yeah, but by the time it came around to it was Jonathan Neal and I were playing around with something, I can't remember what, and in the process of playing around with that, I found that ClearFix thing. But I don't know, it's just, it's kind of a strange thing. It just saves a few lines, like 3 or 4 lines of code. I don't, not the biggest deal, I suppose, but again, it's the sort of thing.
Yeah, but it kind of is, because it's one of the, it's more about what it means, right? Like, let's stop taking things for granted and start looking at, I don't know, why this line of code is there and what it does and whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I quite like doing that.
Yeah. There's still some things that are elusively weird about it, even in like the ClearFix that is the kind of where you stopped on it, I feel like. So it has the before and after as the space in there, and then it's display table, and then it's like, but you only need the I don't mean to drill you on this, but if you don't need the before is what fixes like some weird margin top issue or something.
Yeah.
And if you don't care about that, you can even skip the before too. Yeah. And just make it like display block.
Yeah.
I just don't understand how display table has anything to do with that.
I can't remember either.
Okay, it doesn't matter. Let's
it's
not.
Just it's just for the before part, which yeah, you're right. Yeah. You don't need it unless you want to. So there's two ways that you can clear things like reliably, and one is overflow hidden, and the other is the ClearFix. And if you use overflow hidden, then its drawback is that it does the clipping. If you use ClearFix, then its drawback is that sometimes it will unintentionally clear a float somewhere else, like in, so it will kind of like drop below something else. Yeah. On your page. And if you want to be able to toggle between the two and have them effectively produce almost exactly the same layout in the UI, then having the before just makes sure that that the ClearFix contains the top margin of the first child in the same way that using overflow hidden does. So it's merely for consistency between the two approaches. That's basically it.
See, look, so at this. Like display, didn't remember. He remembered every detail.
Is display table like the only like self-clearing element, or display property?
No, the display kinda? Table is just to give it. Well, it's kind of like when you have the other one as display block. It's just a way of making sure that it definitely is in the right place in the kind of like the display table creates like I don't know anonymous table cell. I think that's something to do with it, but I can't remember exactly the specifics of. I think basically it was an accidental
like
discovery,
an implied in,
and then you kind of go, "Why does this work?" and then try and find out why it works. But I mean,
yeah.
then you're in like W3C specs in your life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
stops abruptly.
Yep.
That's great.
So when you were poking around with this stuff, you were probably in London still.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and then more recently, San Francisco.
Yeah, I moved here about a year ago.
About a year, right? It's been a year. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. To work at the Big Bird at Twitter.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Cool. Cool, cool. So that's Nicholas Gallagher. You all know him intimately now.
And you definitely use his stuff.
Yeah.
Like normal.
Normalize, throw some boilerplate stuff in there. You definitely have used code that Nicholas has worked on. We have, I don't know, do you want to go into this, the EFF thing? Can you explain it to me?
Well, so we do have just a little bit of hot drama this week, and I won't explain it because I'm not a professional at explaining, but the EFF.org, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is that what it is? They made a criticism about the W3C's support of the EME, Encrypted Media Extension, or more commonly known as DRM. So the W3C has HTML Working Group has kind of put through this DRM spec in like it's kind of heading towards browsers to support things like Netflix and Hulu and stuff like that. You know, like big companies with big money and big investment.
Who wouldn't
in the web,
otherwise you know? Otherwise be able to use like HTML5 video, right? They have to use something like Silverlight because that has DRM and the browsers don't, right?
Exactly. And that's like why they can use Silverlight and not Flash, or like they could use Flash, but it's like the Flash DRM is super crackable or whatever. So anyway, it's just kind of interesting that the Electronic Frontier Foundation is now involved in the open web. So, or I guess they've always kind of been, but like they're very seriously It's like a thousand word kind of
and if you are called? They for a or against retort? Yeah, they must be against it.
They're against it. I mean, just from the future of web, right? Like, and there's also this kind of cross post, and I can link to it by Tim Berners-Lee, you know, yeah, where he's talking about like what the web was supposed to be, you know, stuff like that. And yeah, it's kind of like when Tim Berners-Lee invented the internet, he was like, it needs to be open and accessible by everyone. And like, now we're getting into progressive enhancement and stuff like that. But he said, like, you know, when even back like in the 80s or whatever, or 70s or 80s when he was developing this, it's like, or maybe his 90s, but like, he was just like, he knew people had like crappy machines back then. So he was like, you have to make it regardless of the machine. You can't just assume somebody's on a Pentium computer. So you have to assume they have a really crappy machine. So you have to kind of have a base experience and build up on that.
Well,
so,
what's weird about this is that it's not the web, the technology that powers this DRM is still open. That's what's in the, you know, it's just some way to protect the content that ultimately gets displayed there. I know we weren't going to dig into this hole, but I feel like if it's going to go into Chrome, it's going to go into an open source project, and we can see how the DRM works. It doesn't mean that we can crack the DRM content, but it's like, that's the part of the web that should be open. The tech that powers it, the content that comes across can be whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to be this weird thing where every browser has their own EME, and then so you'll need to encode 5 different versions of your videos to be protected, blah, blah, blah.
Well, if that sucks, that sucks. Pretty light on drama. It was light last week and this week. Feel like somebody should get real mad about something next week. So if you feel like...
Yeah, writing some flame posts. Mm-hmm. Next week's the week. Hey, I got a question.
What's that?
From Jeffa00 on Twitter. How do you get a second date with your JavaScript?
How's that, Dave?
You give it a callback. That's good, huh?
Pretty good.
You give it a callback, guys. I got another one for you from Eric Bouchard. Writes in, hey, why did the checkbox get called into the principal's office at W3 schools? Why did the checkbox get called into the principal's office at W3 schools? Because there were complaints that he was bullying people.
Waka, 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 waka.
Hey, just a normal week here in the show. All right.
Bullion. That's a stretch. I love it. Okay. There's some
checkbox bullion. Come on. That's solid. That's gold. Good. That's solid.
I'm glad you didn't
gold.
Mess it up and say radio button, because those are kind of more complicated.
Yeah, that's kind of
Dave Laird.
There's a comment in the chat room that just says, sweet Jesus. You guys are great. Hey, thanks you. Thanks, guys. All right.
Well, meat and potatoes, question and answer. Let's talk about stuff. Dave Laird asks, hey, guys, I am a front-end developer working in Rails these days. I want an automated way to produce style guides. Dave, how do you produce style guides for your clients? Have you been able to automate the process? I feel like he might be asking you, Dave, because you had a post at one point called, like, responsive deliverables, and this has become a common thing lately. Like, you know, if we're working on a big website, let's make a common set of patterns that guide the rest of the site, and then when we build out the site, we can just, you know, pick and choose these patterns and build it. Nicholas, do you have any experience with that type of thing?
No, not really.
Don't you guys use Bootstrap? automating your style guides. I don't, there are a couple of repos out there, like Brad Frost, Atomic Design Patterns.
Alter that and then you have it, right? It's not like it doesn't parse through a style sheet and then creative.
Yeah, I think it's more like stuff like Kyle Neath has KSS.
KSS, right.
Like commenting methodology to generate like the GitHub style guide that they have, I think is generated from it. And I think that's a Rails thing or a Ruby thing anyway, Ruby.
Yeah.
Right. And that's that depends on like strict documentation like in the top of your thing, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
I don't have anything automated. I wish I did.
I think at one point you might have dabbled with some kind of like thing that like auto cloned a specific chunk of HTML and then displayed the HTML how it looked. You know what?
So I wrote like a little jQuery plugin on it's on CodePen actually. So I never actually got it into a thing, but it's called the data code block, and you can kind of find it through there. But basically, you just add a data code block attribute on there on any element, and it'll spit that element out. Like it'll just be like blurp. That's the code you use to make that element, the HTML.
Which is nice. It's the HTML equivalent of like when you make a style, like an inline style element. Not inline, mm-hmm. but you know, the style element in HTML, if you like give a display block and like have it show, that way you can like write CSS in a style guide and you don't have to like then copy it somewhere else to display. It literally is the CSS on that page. You know, it's not useful in day-to-day work, but it's useful in the style guide type of world. And this would be the same thing, right? You can write a chunk of HTML and then you don't have to like then copy and paste it into another place and have to maintain it in two places. It just maintain it in one mm-hmm. place.
It just spits out. So and that, you know, there's like ways you could do it with like PHP partials, I guess, or mustache templates or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I do think it's a thing that needs to be solved. I don't have like a great one. I know the Starbucks, the one they use, the guy who made that, he open sourced that one, but I forget its name right now. I'll try and dig up a show note or something. There are things out there that automate it. I think I like Brad's. I don't know if you guys seen Brad Frost's Pattern Lab. I like it. I mean, it kind of starts from like the smallest thing you could have and goes largest, and then that's like your documentation. And then basically you just need to like siphon those templates. Those are your templates or your partials for building your website. I could maybe see that's maybe hard to maintain in production. I don't know. I'd be curious how that all works. I would like to see like a production thing that spits out to this, to that like whatever that automated
I mean that's what Dave is looking for kind of is
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
I would look at KSS because if he specifically said he's in Rails, KSS is in Ruby, that might be a match made in heaven. It's vetted by big companies, you know, definitely look there first. And good luck. Mm-hmm. And if we there can think of anything else, we'll let you know. Barry Walsh writes in, my question is regarding IE downloading inapplicable style sheets. And I think this would probably be wider than an IE issue because this affects a lot of browsers. I've read two articles and both seem to contradict each other. One states that if you attach a media attribute to like a link, right? So like link rel equals style sheet media equals min width 320 pixels, say, when linking to a style sheet, that IE won't download the file, and the other says that it will download the file. Do you guys have any insight into this? Here are the two articles, and I put this in here because he links up an article on nicholasgallagher.com, mobile first CSS SAS, and IE is that article, and then the other article is a Scott Gell article on CSS inapplicable loading. I think he may be a little confused. I didn't dig into the article so much, but just off the, what's up with this? If you put a media attribute on a link thing, isn't it the case that all browsers download? It doesn't take that into account when it decides whether it's going to download it or not. It only takes into account when it's going to apply it or not. Isn't that right? Did I misrepresent that?
I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. I've always heard, right? I from my understanding, even if you put a media attribute on a link element, the browser gets that file because it's, again, that prefetcher, right? The HTML look ahead preparser grabbing things. Am I right?
That's
what I think. Is that still the case, Nicholas?
I think it's just that like the value of the media attribute doesn't really matter in terms of like the browser's not going to try and guess at what you mean in there. So I mean, I think you can put anything in there. You could put like whatever, like my special TV, and it would still download it. It doesn't know necessarily that it's not going to apply it. So if I wrote that it's not going to download it, then I was probably wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it goes and fetches it regardless, and then it tries to decide if it applies it to the screen.
Right. It's not the worst thing. I mean, it makes a little counterintuitive sense because you might think like, hey, why do you even download this? I'm looking right at the screen. I can tell that you're not going to need that. Why would you download it at all? It just seems like a waste of bandwidth. But like Dave, you said, A, it's prefetching, and B, it's like it might in the future know because of like client hints or like when headers start getting smarter on the web. But at the that early on in the process of parsing that document, it doesn't know if how big the browser window is or what all the stuff that a media query needs to know about. Like that would have to be further along in the process, and it would slow things down. And then let's say, I don't know, you resize the browser window and then the media query becomes true. It'll just immediately take effect if it already has that style sheet. Whereas if it has to download it, there'll be this weird like flash of, style weirdness.
What do you do a lot of responsive stuff, Nicholas? Do you do like mobile first responsive web design?
The last thing that I worked on at Twitter was Twitter cards, and those mm-hmm. are so like below a tweet there's like additional content that a publisher or someone else can display in a tweet that has a link to that piece of content, and that was so that had to be IE8 first, IE8 and above. I mean, so I kind of wrote a little piece of JavaScript that like mimicked media queries by adding a class to the HTML, so it was like the same principle but didn't use CSS media queries for it. Used like basically a class that the JavaScript applied. But in terms of like, so like twitter.com is like loosely responsive. There's a few bits of it that adapt, mm-hmm. but it's not like a fully fledged like mobile first website or anything like that. And I don't think it's going to be anytime soon.
Yeah, it probably doesn't need to be so much that there's so many clients and stuff, right? Like if you're on your phone, you get the MDOT anyway. On the web, and otherwise use a native app or whatever.
I think there's a difference between, so like building a mobile first responsive website, if it's a website that has to be maintained, so a website like an application that basically your entire reason to work at a company like Twitter or GitHub or things like that is to work for probably a few years on just a single application or things that are related to it. And when you have to build like one thing that maybe, I don't know, between like 10 to 50 people are working on every single day, then it's like very, very difficult, I think, to build something that has like various breakpoints that basically you have to test every single breakpoint. And I think it's like that problem in itself is...
Yeah, the bigger the team, the harder that stuff becomes.
Yeah, I think that in itself is a really challenging thing to have to try and work out how are you going to sustainably write code for this kind of thing, and I don't think that there are many examples of that out there at the moment.
I think it would seem like element queries would save the day there in terms of workflow, right? Because you're probably, let's say you're working on Twitter cards, right? Like you just make sure your card has the element breakpoints that it needs, and then boom, Bob's your uncle. It's done, right?
Yeah, like that would definitely, so in the world of web components where you could have completely encapsulated bits of UI, so yeah, if you wanted to build like a tweet box, you would go and write that kind of in isolation. You might pull in some library files or depend on some other components that other people had written. But in effect, you could just focus on a single thing and make sure that that behaved in the ways that you wanted at various sizes and things like that. Then that would be like much, much easier. And I kind of feel like that is how we should want to be building things. We're like so far away from it at the moment, but...
Well, what about iframes? Why don't we just make web apps that are all just little iframes?
Well, I kind of think, like, you joke, but I think that on some level that is the idea behind it is not dissimilar. Yeah. Just without all the performance problems.
I was talking with Tab in the hashtag responsive IRC room. Mm-hmm. That's like a thing that exists now. And he's kind of been mulling around, like proposing something where there's like a, almost like a, don't take my word for it, but like a different kind of layout method, you know, like you could do like display iframe or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And this is not real syntax. warning. This is not real syntax, but just something like that, like display iframe. And then your div would behave like an iframe. And then it could, in theory, kind of like... regulate things, you know you then have those
kind of
like media queries on
styles a little bit where you, like it's kind of it's a fresh slate in there, at least CSS wise, and possibly have some kind of JavaScript
it's like a fresh viewport. So I don't know, I'm very curious to see where that
I mean
goes.
That's similar to web components too, right? Just it's just like an HTML based version of it.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Yep. Web components. Do you use a lot of web components, Nicholas? Is that something you guys are doing?
Well, no, because it's not really supported in any way that we could use. Once you've read about all that stuff and what they're trying to do, it's quite hard to go back to working with the technology we currently have. Like if you've played around with Polymer at all, just the model of thinking about things, like the fact that it brings kind of modules and encapsulation to the web technologies it makes a lot of sense, and it would be really great to work like that. And I hope that we don't have to wait too long until it's viable.
It probably, you know, a couple of years. There's also the kind of going the opposite way too. There's like iframes that are like trying to loosen up a little bit too. There's like let the styles kind of bleed through, but everything else is encapsulated. Yeah. So there's a number of different ways that this can be approached, probably. And then there's like the shadow DOM thing too, which is related to this, which is related to pseudo elements that we talked about earlier too, which I think is kind of cool, right? Like what can we stop having? I mean, pseudo elements are nice to get the like the free little I can make the little arrow out of the thing, and it's useful and it helps me be more semantic or whatever. But why should we? You know, it's they weren't really meant for that, and it's like why is there only two? Like, shouldn't we be able to just make just invent our own little DOM structure that the semantic document doesn't have to see at all? You know, if I want 10 divs in there, I should be able to have them, and I might as well use divs while I'm in there with classes and IDs and stuff. It just shouldn't have to be this weird arbitrary pseudo element. Anyway.
Well, I remember when we were talking, Chris, about like the pseudo element stuff, and there was some spec lying around somewhere about like the future of generated content, and it suggested in there that there would be effectively you could have like infinite pseudo elements. You know, you'd have like before two, before three, before four,
before
all that kind of stuff.
And
I think that, and at the time we were like, oh, isn't it kind of a bit of a shame that this thing isn't being like implemented anywhere? But then when you see web components and you realize that what would have happened with the pseudo elements is that someone would put in like H1. And then in the CSS might have been like 15 pseudo elements doing all this crazy stuff, and you'd have to try and piece together the pseudo DOM that it was making, right? That instead, if you can just do that all much more obviously in a custom element, in effect, with some extra DOM nodes that you sprinkle in, like that, I understand entirely why.
It still looks like an H1. Oh, yeah, I understand it too. It would have been a mess to do it in that way. Especially because it was such a stupid structure anyway. But in a sense, we were both right, though. Like, isn't it a shame that we can't do this? It's like, no, it's not a shame that we can't have before child n or whatever, before n, because that's just weird. But it is a shame that we can't do what we want to do.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, exactly.
however that needs to play out, it would be. And then there wasn't even before and after. There was, well, there's before and after, and then there was like some other thing that would like technically place that. The content that you're about to apply, like it right now, before and after, kind of behave as if they're children, so you can like, but there's some other one that would make it literally go after, so it would be like they're not a children. It's literally after. I forget which one.
That yeah.
Is. Ah, what a mess. Forget it. Custom elements. Shadow DOM, and I think this will be interesting. This relates to content as well. It's almost a shame that HTML is the thing that holds our content. Really, it's almost like there should be another pseudo language that's like, what is the actual content of this document, and then some other document that like is all that structural crap that can largely be ignored. So when something like Google has to parse it, they can just look at the content and forget about this. It's just weird that like the same document that like is responsible for loading up scripts and stuff is this. That's where we put our content too. That seems weird. Whatever. Seems old school.
Well, isn't that like what Polymer and all that stuff is for? I mean, more or less, I guess.
Yeah, Polymer is a like quite an early stage attempt to like provide a small framework to work with this way of doing things. So they have a whole bunch of polyfills to try and give you all the tools that you will have available to you in the web platform in the future. And then you can write your own things like custom elements. Like Angular does this a little bit as well. And I think that I think Angular is heading towards being built on top of the
polymer
same
base,
yeah, polymer base. Mm. And it's quite a nice experience if you try it out.
Yeah, I was like Angular, I was very skeptical, you know. I'm like, JavaScript, MVC, blah, 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 that's terrible or whatever, or not going to work. But then like somebody was explaining it and it was just like they had an element like open bracket, bar chart, close bracket. And I was just like, oh, my God, you can do that. You know, obviously you can do that. It's not going to validate or whatever. But like that's super semantic about what they're getting at what that thing does, you know, rather than like div, ID, bar chart, bunch of crap, presentational divs, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just very, very interesting to me.
It's kind of like, it is on some level, just a better templating system than what we currently use. So for that alone, it's pretty good.
And a little bit of hot drama. Do you think Google's doing that because the W3C working group, the what working group moves too slow? Huh?
I don't think so, no.
Huh? Are you sure? I'm just.
I don't know why they're doing it. I just think that from what I've heard with the few people that I've spoken to about it, that what they're trying to do of having people play around with the proposed technologies and they themselves like working to implement it is like a really is the way that I think people want things to be done, because they're kind of getting feedback very early before it's a standard and built into browsers. They're getting to, you know, suggest changes and alternative ways of doing some of the parts of it, just all in the hope of having a better standard when it's decided upon. So I think that, I mean, it seems really sensible to me what they're doing. I mean, everything that part of Google does is kind of mind-blowing if you think about the resources they put behind it and the kind of people they have working on it. So I just hope that, yeah, they just keep doing what they're doing. It looks good to me.
I think now is a good time to announce my A Book Apart book, Developing for X-Internet, subtitle, The Shadow DOM. That's my new X-Internet.
Okay. Shadow DOM is the world's right, coolest Chris. Thing to be named something. Anyway, yeah.
I know. That's going to be my Halloween costume.
Lynda.com, probably the I can say this for sure, it's the biggest learning resource for like video training content for all kinds of digital learning stuff on the web. Lynda.com, there's over 2,000 courses on it, and a course can be like 6 hours long. I think mine was at least that long, which is crazy. It's like just tons and tons of videos, and you bookmark them, and then you're watching on your computer, and then you go watch on your iPad and stuff. You have one account, and it's all synced up, and it's pretty cool. There's a new course added every single day on lynda.com, these big, long courses, which is pretty rad. It just starts at $25 a month, You get a week free if you go to lynda.com/shoptalk and sign up through that, which is pretty cool. 2 million active members on lynda.com. It's a huge place to be hanging out. And, you know, there's all this web learning stuff. All these things that we're talking, I doubt there's a course on the Shadow DOM yet. You know, they're going to wait for Dave's book to come out first, I think. But there is some pretty modern stuff in there. You know, you want to learn Objective-C development or whatever, some Rails stuff. All that stuff is in there. Searchable transcripts for it all, too. So you can be like, oh, what were they saying? And then search for what they said and then find it in the transcript. So that's pretty good, right, for all their courses. Again, check it out, lynda.com/shoptalk. Naaman Goel has a question here. What do you think, Dave?
I can do it. Naaman Goel writes in, I'm a huge fan of inline blocks. I always use them instead of floats. They reflow, and I don't need row divs. The only issue is spacing, but I account for that. Is there any reason why the whole world is using floats? Also, I've used an extra div with a height of 100% and a width of 0, and then use vertical align middle just for making things vertically centered. In the last episode, you talked about doing this stuff with pseudo elements. Can you explain that a bit?
So the first question is, Naaman likes inline blocks and not floats.
Yeah. Why? So why do people still use floats? Nicholas, you got?
I think it's just.
Where are you on this float, not inline block?
I think the difficulty with inline block is that if you have white space in the source code between the blocks that are inline block or the elements that are inline block, that you can end up with like space appearing.
Yeah, you can't have four divs in a row, say inline block and say 25% each and have them all be in one row. They'll break because there's too much.
You have to find some way to either get rid of the white space in your templates or to write some CSS that like tries to do away with it. And it's a little bit fiddly. Like, I think the most reliable one is to use font size 0 to collapse that white space, mm-hmm. and then reset the font size using like font size 1 rem or something.
Which then that sucks if you are trying to cascade your font sizes through it and stuff. You know, it's not that big of a deal, but you got to work around it. You know, you got to reset it. It doesn't work great with M's. You know, it's fine with rem's, but if you're in an M based thing and you set it to 0, then you gotta use a pixel based value. Like one element up, so it's like kind of reset back to normal and stuff. And you're right, Naaman, you don't have to clear it. Pretty cool, right? But you do have to do all this crap, so it's a horse apiece, right? It's like it sucks both ways.
Yep. Another advantage of using inline block is if you're doing LTR, RTL, it'll auto flip your template.
That's nice.
Think about that.
And this is, we're talking about columns, essentially, right? Inline block isn't a replacement if you have an image and you want it to take up half of one column and have the text flow around it, there's no substitute for float. That's what float is for. You know? So.
Yeah. I still use floats. I like them. And clear fixing is easy for me. And I also feel like there's like a good separation between rows. That said, I don't know why I don't just minify my HTML, like using grunt or something like that. And like why I don't do that in development, you know, like I'm making a template and then it builds out somewhere minified. Cause that would solve all these problems, right? Wouldn't that solve the white space problem?
I think it can be a bit tricky to collapse white space in HTML reliably because you don't necessarily want to collapse it all because sometimes that white space is significant. Like if you have a collection of spans together in a piece of text, you don't want the white space between them to be collapsed necessarily. So it can be a bit tricky.
I think they're approaching it somehow. I heard there's some kind of either a new property that is going to account for this, or it's like display inline block no space, or I don't know. That's absolutely not what it's going to be. But there's some kind of idea here because of the, I don't know. It's coming soon, and I'll link it up if I can find it. Naaman also asked about this. I think he was asking about this height 100% thing and doing some vertical centering, which is kind of a little interesting technique that I wrote up a while back that I heard from somebody else. And I can link up the article in which I quote the actual author of it, but it was kind of clever. It's like, let's say you have a div that's an unknown height, but it has a height, right? It's not just height auto or whatever the default value of a div is, how it just grows as tall as it can get. Let's say it has a height, but that height could be anything. If you put a div in there with that's inline block and make it height equals 100%, it will be the same as tall as the div. It just, that's how that would work. And instead of using a div, you could use a pseudo element. So let's say you have a div that you're trying to vertically center in this unknown height box. You can make a pseudo element before it that is, you know, display inline block and a height equals 100%, and then set vertical align middle on it. And then that little ghost element, which is just nothing, it's just like one pixel of space, will then vertically center that box in the middle of it. And I know that might be a little hard to picture over the radio, but I'll link it up. And I think that's might be what you're asking. It's like using a fake little element to do some vertical centering in an unknown space. It's pretty clever, I think.
Sweet. All right. Hopefully that makes sense. Have you used that in production though, Chris?
I don't know what that even means. You know, I know what you mean.
In
but like,
real life?
Yeah, like, I would use it. I mean, pseudo.
Like, you're like, hey, mom, just do this.
I would use it in production, absolutely. Because there's nothing browser challenged about it other than pseudo elements, which are, I don't know, IE8 up, right? Which is fine.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Here we go. All right. Next question. Josh Bailey writes in, I am approaching graduation and want to create a blog for myself to document and share what I learned. Not such a bad idea, right? Is it crazy not to use a CMS? I want to build this from the ground up myself. It'll be a learning experience for myself. So, question, is it crazy not to use a CMS? Chris Coyer, who probably just wrote a blog post on this.
Oh, I didn't. What does Nicholas Gallagher run on? It doesn't strike me as a WordPress site.
It is, yeah.
It's really? A WordPress site. Damn. Does it look like one?
If I had to rebuild it today, like if I didn't have a blog and I was making one, I probably wouldn't use WordPress.
Right. Would you? Because it's so, I mean, to me, it looks like a static site generator type of site.
Right, exactly. I wouldn't need it. So, right. I mean, I probably wouldn't bother with comments and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, you would just ditch the comments. Now, that's a thing that you would get, Josh, with a CMS, is you just get a comment system for free. And if you want a comment system anyway, even on a static site generator site, you could just drop in something like discuss and then you got them. So it's not that big of a deal. I like to own my comments just because, you know, CSS Tricks is like my job kind of. So having a comment system with these comments that I own and are there and doesn't reply on any third parties or whatever, and then I can integrate with other areas of the site, it makes sense for me. I know this isn't about me, but I'm just giving you a counterpoint here. So you're saying, Nicholas, you would probably go with whatever, Jekyll or do you have a favorite?
Some kind of, not really. I'd probably look into it a bit more. I mean, Jekyll's the obvious one.
Yeah.
I guess I just wouldn't want to spend as much time as I did originally poking around in WordPress's internals and with PHP code and having to learn like all the things I had to do to output various pieces of text in the way that I wanted it. So that's
funny that your impression is that it'll be simpler.
Well, I guess so. To have the site and the code generated it that I wanted was just involved a bit of exploratory work.
Right.
These days, I'd probably not want to waste as much time on that.
It probably would be. It's certainly simpler, kind of the end result is simpler. But I think most people generally, when they think of static site generators, just because they're newfangled-ish, that they think is like, oh, I'm going to have to learn something new.
Well, I guess when I first made my blog, I didn't know what Git was.
Yeah, you didn't know either one, so you have to learn something.
So the idea of being like, so to write a blog post, you write a file and then do like, you know, Git push origin master and sign up for GitHub. I'd be like, what is all this? Like, how do I use? I wouldn't have even known how to exit VI on the command line. Like, so
yeah, colon so trade, W trade one Q thing. Something.
That took me forever to learn that.
Yeah, well, so I made the move to static site generators. They're actually, they are great. I love them, but
that's a CMS though, isn't it? Technically,
It's yeah, technically it is a CMS. I would advise against making a CMS, like, or like building yours from the ground up. I mean, I feel like the reason WordPress exists, or, you know, even that what's that new one? Ghost, try Ghost, yeah, or whatever. Awesome. It's like, the reason these like CMSs kind of exist is because like people fought some really hard battles, right? Like how do I get RSS working? How do I get like posting from my phone to work? How do I get, you know, there's a lot of like groundwork that's been done for you. And there's also been a lot of like, security work. There's also been a lot of plugins and stuff like that. Like if you want to put, I don't know, your Stack Overflow questions, there's probably a plugin for that and you don't have to write it from scratch. So, it would be a learning experience to like build a CMS, but I would just do that for something else. I don't know, your social network for dogs, do that on the side in a, you know, from the ground up, and then just keep blogging and sharing in the easiest way possible. I think that's for me, that's what it comes down to, is blogging should be as easy as possible for you. And that line to posting should be quick, and that will be
bring your learning experience elsewhere.
Yeah, like you're gonna learn stuff. I mean, if you're like creating a blog for yourself, like you're like, oh shoot, I wanted to put in, I don't know, that Stack Overflow. I wanted to put in all my Stack Overflow upvotes, and there's no plugin that does that, so I had to write a plugin for that, and here it is. I'm sharing it, and then like, boom, you get a million hits because that's the most successful plugin idea the world has ever known. So it's that easy. I think when it comes to blogging, reduce friction and then you'll blog more. IMHO.
Yep. I have some thoughts on that I'm going to save.
Oh, really? Like offline?
No, here it is in a nutshell, Dave. This is specifically offensive to you.
Hit me. I switched to Jekyll and I don't blog.
Yes. I don't know. And not only do you not blog, which is fine. I mean, you're busy. You have a child and stuff. Nobody that has a static site generator blog is a prolific blogger.
That's fair. No,
there's not one that posts every day. Not that you have to. I'm just saying, anybody I know who is actively blogging, they don't use Jekyll.
Tim Smith does.
Tim Smith. Let's give a dang out for Tim.
Dang. Okay.
Tim Smith does.
Artifact Conf. That's the actual URL. Artifact Conf. It's an hour outside of Boston. Providence, Rhode Island. And that, you know, I keep having to associate Boston with it because that's how they sent us the notes for it. But Providence is a cool town all of itself, I've heard.
Providence.
It happened the first time in Austin. Dave spoke at it. It's happening again here in Providence. God dang it. Dave's going to be there again. Sweet lineup. Yeah. Tons of people that have been on the show before and tons of people that haven't, which I will troll the speaker list to get on the show. Anyway, it's an in-person conference, and it's about, you know, it's about front end and stuff. It's a 2-day single track conference, designers, and the kind of overall theme is a multi-device world. Yeah, is that accurate? I wasn't able to go to the first one. Is that true, Dave?
No, it's totally cool. It's like, yeah, it's like multi-device world from a design perspective. At least that's the first iteration. I think this will be very similar. It's a lot of designers who are speaking and creative directors and stuff like that. So, you know, we always talk about responsive design from like just a pure CSS perspective, like, you know, just very, very like nuts and bolts. This is a media query. This is how you make something pink at 400 pixels. This is more about like, how do you do this with clients involved, and, you know, how do you achieve things you know, emotion and stuff like that. So, very, very cool. And what's awesome is, Jen Robbins, she like handpicks the speakers just so that she can kind of build a story. So it's really awesome. I was impressed. It feels like you're hanging out with family.
November 4th through 6th. The Biltmore Hotel looks lovely. Use coupon code SHOPTALK for $100 off. Let's do another question, shall we?
That's a good one. Yeah, let's do this one for Phil Thompson. Writes in, hey guys, I'm currently applying for a dev job with a company, Twitter, let's say, and they told me in one of the interviews that they use Less instead of SaaS. Maybe it was Twitter. I've personally been using SaaS Compass for a while now and feel confident in it, but if I get this job, I will have to change to Less. Womp womp. Here we go. What are the key things I need to bear in mind when changing from SaaS to Less? And do you know of any good blog posts or videos that can help me with the change? Thanks.
I put this in here because I do want to know how it actually goes down at Twitter. Last I heard, it's kind of department by department, right? There's no like Twitter wide decree of which preprocessor you're using, is there? Or if you use
Yeah, that's right. There isn't one.
Yeah. And if you use them at all, do you?
TweetDeck uses SaaS. The revenue team uses Less. Twitter.com doesn't use any preprocessor at all at the moment. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of project by project. I know that a couple of projects that use Bootstrap as a base, they obviously use Less to just because Bootstrap uses Less. So it's a little bit there's no central decree.
Yeah. Which, you know, it's probably fine. I don't know. I mean, it's a pretty nice website. So that's usually my top determination whether it's a good idea or not. So the question is this person knows SaaS. I'm sorry. I should name them by name because that's the appropriate thing to do. Phil, you're trying to switch. It will take you 5 minutes to switch. It will take you an hour to switch, realistically. It's like Mixins are like a little bit more like Extends or whatever. It's just a class name. So you use a dot instead of at include, right? It's like there's a couple of trivial differences. The thing for a variable is different. It's an at sign instead of a dollar sign, right? Done.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that simple, but it's like you've learned more complicated things in your life, Phil, and you've learned one preprocessor. It's going to be a non-starter.
I learned Less first and then learned SaaS afterwards, and like I didn't know either when I first started using them, but it's pretty simple. It'll be okay.
Yeah.
At the risk of being a synergy scumbag, lynda.com has a really awesome video tutorial on both Less and SaaS, so you could watch all the Less videos.
Yeah, sure, that's a way to do it. You know what? You may Google around and find an article that explains the differences in them. I don't even think you're going to need it. It's so trivially different. I wouldn't like put these, you know, don't put the preprocessor on a pedestal. I just gave a talk about this where I'm like, they're like, oh, I have to learn this whole new syntax. That's like a barrier that I hear once in a while on switching to preprocessors. I'm like, oh my God, it's going to take you an hour. It's like variables, mix in, extends, and well, I don't know. That's about it, right?
There's like three or four things.
It's like not a big deal. And they're very obvious programmery things. You don't need to teach someone how to use a variable. It's just as easy as you think it's going to be. The only, you know, occasionally you'll come up to a thing like, oh, I want to use a variable name like as a selector. And when I try to do that, it's weird. And you got to then learn that language's way to like escape the selector or whatever, which is occasionally weird in SAS where you have to do the Ruby like
pound
with the bread. Yeah. Mustache-y. Right. So you're like, oh, that's weird. Yeah. So you got to learn that. But you just learn it the first time it comes up, you know? And you know, there's a pretty good place to find examples of weird looking SaaS and Less is on CodePen, honestly. Just like find an example of somebody that, like, you know, I don't know, or some article on CSS Tricks. The latest one was about this guy who made a conical gradient. And it's just incredibly cool. It's like uses a SAS loop to make little pie pieces, ends up looking like a Trivial Pursuit piece with different colors, you know, and then uses WebKit Blur to just boosh them all together into a conical gradient. It's a pretty cool technique, and it looks beautiful when it's done. That uses a SAS, and there's a SAS loop in there, and then there's that escaped thing that I was just talking about. There's an example of that in there. And it's like, if you can understand those 10 lines of SAS, that pretty much covers the gamut of SAS syntax. So that'll look a little funky at first, but individually the concepts are very easy. Don't worry about it, Phil. You'll be fine.
Yeah. And you know, it's like for loops, right? Those would be different.
Yeah.
I still don't know how to write a for loop in JavaScript, so I Google it every time.
You can type for tab in CodePen. Just a little trick there, and we'll give you a little stub out a for loop for you. Less doesn't do for loops, but they have guarded mixins or something. You can write like a recursive mixin in Less. It's a little funky. That's one of the things that annoys me about Less.
It's funky. It's funky. The thing of the day. All right. So, do we have one time for one more? Maybe we, I think we do. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Let's do a quick one here. Nicholas, are you a computer science graduate? Cause that might affect.
Isn't it something weird like sociology or something? What? Not weird.
Anthropology.
Anthropology.
Whoa. So,
I know nothing about computer science.
You dig up bones? Is that?
That's archaeology.
It was the study of its
culture. It can be anthropology. That's sort of
cultures and stuff, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Oh, I screwed it up too, Dave.
That's why I have a liberal arts degree in Japanese.
You know, when you try and explain to someone who says, like, what's your job? And you're trying to explain, like, what web developer designer is.
Yeah,
that's kind of what I feel like explaining anthropology. It's kind of like, well, it's sort of like I can't really explain it in a succinct way, so I won't bother.
Yeah, yeah.
So less bones, more... Right. Here we go. This one for Brandon Kepke writes in, one thing I used to do when I wanted to learn practice HTML CSS is to pick out a theme I liked and start a PSD starting with a PSD of it and turn it into a HTML CSS design. You encounter more scenarios this way than your rookie brain may have dreamed up on its own. It takes away the challenge of coming up with a subject, quote unquote, to work on, allowing you to focus on turning design patterns into code. I did the same with Photoshop. I would cruise, dribble, and then do my best to copy all the little web design elements and patterns I liked, buttons, ribbons, gradients, icons, etc. Zooming all the way to pixel level, if possible. Noticing the little details and asking Google questions the whole way until I had a pixel perfect match. And finally, learn how to use browser debuggers to encounter something cool on a website. You know, how to open up and figure out how they did it. So that's less of a question.
Yeah, I put this in here because it was kind of not a question. It was like this is how you learn kind of thing, is to find something that you like online and copy it. Find something that you, a design you like, and copy it in Photoshop. Find something and dig into the dev tools and figure it out. It was a good sentiment by Brandon that explains how he did this. It was, I mean, and you know, maybe we could comment on it just a second. Is that the kind of thing that you did, Nicholas, when you learned, or do you remember what that was like, considering you don't have a computer science degree? And what was that learning process?
Yeah, it was. I distinctly remember. I had Front Page, and then when I had to do, like when I was really learning how to code, I downloaded, got a copy of Dreamweaver, mm-hmm. and reverse engineered some of its crappy templates and tried to understand what was going on in them. And then I would take other people's websites and I would view source. And then I started looking at other people's websites and basically rebuilding them myself in a way that I thought was could apply some of the things that I knew. So it was a constant effort of trial and error, breaking other people's stuff, copying other people's stuff. Like, that was definitely how I did it as well.
Nice. Total agreement there on how that worked. That's funny that it was Dreamweaver templates. And you probably spent
the worst place to learn from.
You probably spent like £399 on it or whatever. Right? And I'm sure it was.
Completely legitimate. Yeah. Definitely. Just want to reinforce that point.
I meant to hit the cash register, but I hit that one.
Just as good, really.
Just as good. I actually want to do a poll, and maybe we should do a shop, or this is a good CSS tricks poll, is like, was or was not your first copy of Adobe software?
I might avoid that one, actually.
I mean, like, no, but like, serious research is like, does pirating turn into customers later on, or does it? Like,
I have a theory about this, which is that they don't mind, well, they turn a blind eye to the rampant pirating of it on an individual level. Because then it means that when all these people who learn by getting a cracked copy of Photoshop or whatever turn up at their employer has to, like, everyone that they're hiring expects to have Photoshop and stuff like that available to them. So suddenly they get all the big bucks from the employer having to get like a 100,000 person license.
That's a great theory. So
that's my theory.
Well, but does Creative Cloud break that though? Because now you can only get Photoshop through the cloud, right?
Well, we'll find out if in 5 years' time no one's using Adobe products at work.
I'm just curious, like if they have sacrificed.
You don't have to use cloud though yet, or you think that's where they're headed?
Yet, I think. Well, I think. Yeah, I think those other versions are getting deprecated or whatever. The standalone.
I'm not on cloud. I like the. I just don't like that I have to like check online to see if you're a customer or not and stuff. I'm like, that's weird. I'm just. I want to. Yeah. It's local software anyway.
But you get Typekit, dog.
Do you?
How about that Typekit, though?
That's kind of good, though, actually.
It's like a... yeah, that's pretty good. It's still... It's weird. It's
You don't just have their whole library, right? You have to, like, request it and...
You pick... Well, so that's what's cool about Adobe Cloud is, like, you can pick and choose the apps you actually use or want, you know? So you just be like, oh, I want to try Adobe Muse and, like, install it. But I don't know. But I'm just curious if this like is going to lead to. I'm just curious because I got an education version, my first one, which is like $15 or something like that. So, but like for me as like a student to start spending $30 a month, $50 a month, that would be very, very hard. So, I would probably just buy Sketch or something. You know,
right?
$10.
So this theory might be true. It might be us. Adobe, are you listening? Your whole business model's falling apart.
No, I'm not calling them out or anything. I'm just curious how. I want to talk to an economist. I don't know. Let's get an economist on the show.
I'm announcing my next Malcolm
or
Gladwell.
Or an anthropologist. If we only had an anthropologist on the show.
Okay. Oh.
All right. Hey. Nicholas, thanks so much for coming on our precious little show.
Thanks for having me on.
For those who aren't following you or that, how can they follow you, get in touch with you, give you money? How does that work?
Just on Twitter, I suppose. Like that's pretty much it. My handle is like I don't know how it's NECOLAS. That's how you say it.
Nicolas.
Something like that. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. And thank you, Twitter, for giving us one of your core developers. and thank you, listeners, for coming out into the chat room. You guys always give us awesome facts and quite a bit of humor for me today. And thank you guys very much. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. And give us a 5 in whatever podcast app you use. And Chris, you got anything else?
ShopTalkShow.com.